In 1946, Australians who went to the cinema saw this newsreel story. It was titled, Mrs. Ethel Livesey Tells Her Story. The cinema-goers looked on the screen and they saw a very nice-looking lady. And she's sitting in a living room, speaking very earnestly to the camera.
I have taken this opportunity to speak to the public through this medium, because what I have to say cannot be turned maliciously against me or distorted. I have suffered severely in the past few weeks through the publicity that has been given me, of which I have not sought. I have had many hard knocks in my life. Perhaps if some of those who have turned against me could have seen a little of the suffering that I have seen, they may have had a little more kindness to have shown to me in my trial. I am not ashamed of anything I have done, and I can look everybody in the face. I wonder if they could do the same.
Now, what you should know is that on screen, Ethel Livesey looks like such a sweet and decent lady. But in 1946, Ethel was at the centre of a major scandal when her society wedding in Sydney had to be called off just 2 hours before the lavish ceremony was to take place, because Ethel Livesey was an imposter and possibly one of the greatest grifters in our history. Ethel Livesey had 8 official marriages, 5 divorces. She used over 40 aliases. She had claimed in her time to be a cotton heiress, a wartime spy, an opera singer, and a close friend of the king, when she was none of those things. She swindled so much money from seriously rich men and some poor ones too. Frieda Marnie Nichols is my guest. Frieda stumbled on the story of this spectacularly brazen human being, and she's written an extraordinary book called The Amazing Mrs. Livesey. Hi, Frieda.
Hello, Richard.
Doesn't she look like the sweetest lady in that newsreel?
Oh, yes. And the first time I saw it, I just went, my goodness, what a story. She must just have had the most incredible life. And then to find out her life and find out what a blatant liar she was really quite something.
I've been reading bits aloud to my producers, and then she did this, and they were going,
No.
And I was like, yes, she did this.
Yep.
She looks like the queen in that video. That's the amazing thing about it. Tell me, first of all, how did you find this story? She seems to have been forgotten to the rest of the country.
Oh, yes. I mean, in the 40s, she was huge, and the 50s. Prior to that, she kept herself hidden really quite well. But a girlfriend was trying to find her dad's birth certificate and had found, in the process, a whole lot of newspaper articles about her grandmother. Dating from this great big society wedding, and that she was a con artist, and then she went to court and all these things. And we had lunch one day. I hadn't caught up with her for a while, and she was telling me this story. And everyone loves doing their family tree, and when we did our family tree, and I found that someone was, a child must have been 5 months premature by dates, with marriage to birth. That was a huge scandal, let alone someone like this. I mean, this isn't a skeleton. This is just a graveyard, this one. But she really was quite something else. And seeing that newsreel, my girlfriend Loita's daughter Jessica found it on the internet, and I saw the newsreel and heard her story and just thought, my goodness. But then to actually find the truth after all that time, when you were saying with your producer, we're on a farm and my husband would come in and, we'd be talking about our day, and I say, how was your day, dear, sort of thing. And I said, you will not believe what she's done now.
So you've been on this kind of detective trial to try and find, and you've found a trail that goes all the way back to Manchester in England, which is where it all starts.
Yes.
Now, she was born into a family in Manchester. Tell me the family name she was born into.
It's so ironic. Her maiden name was Swindells, and the name of the book was almost The Great Swindell.
She was born by the name of Ethel Swindell?
Ethel
Swindells.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Stress on the second syllable. Were they a well-to-do family in Manchester?
They were comfortable. They were sort of middle class. Her father was a cotton buyer, and the Swindells name itself was, they were distantly related to the very wealthy Swindells who owned 7 mills. So I think, having that surname that was instantly recognisable probably helped her develop the tendency to tell stories to get what she wanted.
The first of her official marriages was to a man called Alec Carter, who was a soldier. And this is at the outbreak of the Great War, World War One, and he went off to the front. But before he left, he gave her something, which was given to wise, called a ring paper. Can you just explain how that worked?
That was interesting. It was only during World War One. The ring paper, instead of a soldier getting their pay overseas and somehow having to get it to their family back home, when they were stationed away, they could apply for a ring paper, which was a piece of paper which had the person's name on there, all their details, they were the dependent of, you know, that sort of thing. And they had to go to the post office once a week, and there'd be a huge ledger there, and they would be ticked off. And it had to be the same post office, of course, because, you know, so they got the right ledger. And they would be given the wages so that they could buy food, look after the kids.
Right, so that's how she could claim a soldier's income, her husband's soldier's income.
That's right.
Very, very sadly, he was reported to her not long afterwards as being missing in action, presumed dead. What did she do then once she was told that her husband was probably dead?
She was pregnant with her first child, and she was back living with her own family because I assume she wasn't getting on with the mother-in-law at the other. And she gave birth to her first boy, Frank. When he was very young, she just, in the middle of the night, walked out the door with nothing.
She took off.
She just, I guess, you know, it's what we'd call baby blues now or that sort of thing. You know, she just couldn't handle it.
And what became of the son once she left home?
He, eventually, because she didn't return, his father wasn't missing in action. Well, he wasn't dead, as she presumed, but by then she was already remarried. Rather than come back and face the music, she didn't return, so the son went back to
The family
father.
Home, yeah, right. Yeah. She holed up after she walked out in a lodging house.
The Black Horse Inn.
Yes, the Black Horse Inn.
Scandal.
She was brought into the care of a soldier named Billy Smith, and they were eventually arrested for giving false information. This was like at the time when unwed couples were not allowed to share a lodging house.
Oh, heavens no.
No, right. No. But they were unwed. What story did she give the court about her and Billy Smith, the soldier who'd taken her in?
She blamed him entirely because at the court she found that he was already married and had children, and she was quite mortified by this fact. She thought she might have been able to get his ring paper. Yes, she stood up in court and brazenly accused him of plying her with alcohol, and she was sick and he took advantage of her. And amazingly, the magistrate just let her go after this amazing speech. And poor Billy was charged with, put in jail for 6 months.
So she takes off again to Blackpool, the seaside resort in Britain, such as it is, Blackpool.
It was very big back then.
And that's when she gets married to another soldier, Corporal Raymond Ward. Did that get her another ring paper then?
Sure did.
So she had two ring papers at this point?
No, she didn't.
She set aside the first one, right. Yeah. As Ethel Ward, as she now was, with her second husband, she shared the same name as a famous actress who was also called Ethel Ward.
Yes.
Was this a thing she repeated throughout
her
life?
It's the first time I found that she did that. And it was certainly something that, it became very common. It was almost like she was taking herself into a fantasy world, because she would assume movie stars or actresses or, you know, opera singers' names, and she would sort of fill that role and loved it. It sort of helped her story, I think.
Like her first husband, her second husband went off to the Western Front to fight. Mm-hmm. What kind of a life was she living in Blackpool in his absence?
She was having a wonderful time. She was entertaining other men, met another fellow, didn't actually officially marry him, but he put her down as, felt sorry for her because he'd probably heard the story of the grieving war widow, which was her
first husband, yes.
Yes. And it was a story that she continued for a long time. And he felt sorry for her, so actually made her his dependent. So she then had two ring papers.
Did that mean if she had two ring papers, would she then have to go to two separate post offices?
She did. Right. She did, yes. And make sure they weren't the same one.
Right. It would be really important then to get the name right, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, and that came undone rather dramatically.
Okay, how did that come undone?
Now, I can't remember which order it was, but she went to one post office where she was normally Mrs. Ward and presented Mrs. Smith's papers, and the lady questioned it, and so she grabbed the paper back and went on the run.
She started buying expensive clothes in Blackpool on credit.
Yes.
How did she come unstuck with that?
Oh, no, that's she, that was a very interesting set of things to read. Mrs. Hall was a shopkeeper who fell for her story rather heavily, and let her have, I think it was £20 on credit.
That's a lot of money in those times,
it was,
isn't it?
It was probably, top of my head, about $3,000. No, I think it's more.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of money to have on credit. And she, the list of things that she was getting, hats, shoes, all sorts of things. But the one thing that ended up being her undoing was a bright red feather boa. And Mr. and Mrs. Hall went out in the town one evening, Mrs. Hall saw this grieving war widow in the arms of a sailor dancing around with the same red feather boa that she hadn't paid for, and she came unstuck rather severely.
She could always make a good speech in a courtroom.
Oh, totally.
Couldn't she? Yeah. And she did give this speech about being the grieving war widow, and said it was all a misunderstanding, money, I was expecting money to be in the account.
Yes.
Does she have this ongoing history of giving a good speech in a courtroom?
I think it's just a good speech everywhere. You would read witnesses' testimonies in, you know, police records or courts or whatever. She had the gift of the gab, well and truly. She could charm, and she could tell people what they wanted to hear. And so, she would feed them. There was always as I've since found out, with con artists, there's a thread that does tend to stay with their stories. And so she always came from money, from cotton. So that was often and so then people would feel comfortable because she could speak beautifully. She was always immaculately dressed. And shopkeepers would just fall under her spell.
Oh, they just buy this lady, the persona.
Yes.
Right.
You know, offer they, you know, in later cases in the 30s, people would offer her clothes or shoes or whatever because she could bring her friends into their shop. I mean, it was just, she had that ability just to con well and truly. She was amazing.
After she sort of gets warned off with a good behaviour bond, she becomes this, it seems to me like this is when she becomes a proper full-on con artist.
I think so, yeah.
She sets up shop with a man called Fred Lee who has an illegal casino in Blackpool. Mm-hmm. They're fleecing customers there, and she gets the names wrong on the ring papers, and that's where she gets arrested and goes to jail. How did she take that? Do you know anything about her time, your first stint in jail for 6 months?
No. Not really.
It wouldn't have been pleasant, though, would it?
No. I went and researched a bit on Strangeways, which of course is now closed. But it was fascinating. Even old photos dating back to the 20s, which was just after she was there. It was a pretty cold, dark, miserable place. And it was also where they housed the political prisoners, the Irish political prisoners. I'm sure she was horrified that she was, put in this place when all she was trying to do was live the life she wanted rather than
passing
kill somebody.
Off as a nice lady and doing hard labour in strange ways. Yes.
Yes.
Out of prison, she marries again, cleans the guy out, takes off, marries again, cleans the guy out, takes off. This is her MO after this?
While she still can.
She's charming. Mm-hmm. Is she beautiful and seductive?
I find her attractive, especially younger. The photo that we actually have on the cover, where I found in one of the divorce files, and she looks so happy. I love that photo. She's just got the most beautiful blue eyes. And lots of people comment in their statements about her blue eyes. And my girlfriend actually has almost the same blue eyes, as did her father, her granddaughter. And so, yes, I think she held your attention, and she certainly wasn't, when most people, when they think of a beautiful con artist, that would be sort of Hollywood beauty. She wasn't that, but she certainly, she wasn't unattractive. And I think as soon as she started to spin her spell, people wanted to believe her.
It seems like she was able to make people feel very, very good.
Yes, I think so.
Make them feel really good about themselves, and make them want to help her without her even asking.
Yes.
She seems to have been very good at that.
And judging people, because some people would naturally be empathetic and want to help her because if she was a grieving war widow or she was trying to feed her children in a depression or something like that. But other times she would sort of pander to what she thought they wanted to hear. You know, like she could, like, you know, in the 30s, about I can bring clients into your shop,
yes.
You know, that sort of thing. So she was a very good judge of character, and I think very quick.
But she, yeah, quick is the word.
Yeah,
like she
yeah.
could meet a man and 2 days later be married.
Exactly.
Wow.
And out the door with a wedding ring, engagement ring, and most of his money.
Yes. So I mean, you have to speculate about sexual allure, but of course these things weren't spoken of at the time, were they?
Heavens
Can you
no.
get a hint of that?
Or? Again and again, with men in particular, who made statements about her, her leading, I guess, introduction into that was she would place her hand on the fellow's thigh. And
that's all it takes for us guys, is it?
That's all it takes. Might be. Or especially back then.
Is it that bad?
No, back then. I mean, good gracious. Nobody spoke about sex. Nobody even, you know, went down that path.
Right.
So,
and so men are not thinking too clearly at that point, I suppose.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And yeah. So I know.
So, Fred, how does she make her way to Australia then for the first time? Who's the first husband to take her there?
Yeah, it's at the very end of World War One. And she's been fleecing all these servicemen. She's married a few, on the run, all that sort of thing, and meets this very attractive, very handsome war hero, a Captain Giblet. And he falls under her spell, tells him the most incredible story about her being a spy in the continent. I know. So they marry, and they wait for a berth back to Australia. And I think she might have, that's probably one of the longest times she was with a fellow. They were together just over 3 years. He was from Normanhurst on the outskirts of Sydney, which was pretty much bush suburbia back then. And he took over the post office from his father.
Life as a postmistress wouldn't have been too satisfactory for too long for her,
no,
would it?
I think the suburbia bored her because he then rented a house for her in North Sydney so she could be closer to the city. And he'd come down, catch the train down and visit her.
He rented a property just for her,
for
North Sydney.
In
right,
North
so
Sydney.
She could be close to the bright lights, big city.
Yes, that's it.
How did Norm Giblet eventually twig that she wasn't quite who she said she was?
Yeah, this was in the divorce file. It was really interesting. He came across some blotting paper, and it was, it was in reverse, of course, from some letters that she'd written, and he became suspicious, went looking, found some letters, and Ethel snatched them and destroyed them before he could look at them. So he was suspicious that something wasn't quite right.
Hello.
Yeah, for a while, and then he eventually found a blotting paper that referred to her son and her father, and he was under the impression that she was orphaned. So straight up, he just said, hello, you know, this, how can you be writing to your father?
Oh, what did he say when, what did she say when he confronted her with this?
Her version isn't in the divorce file, but I guess I surmised that she just did the whole tears and, please, Norm, everything's okay. But he then also in the divorce file then found that she was already married to Alec Carter.
Who had been found alive, right.
Who was alive, and she knew he was alive. So she had known that she was a bigamist when she married him. I mean, he didn't know about Ray Ward or Jack Smith or any of the others, so that was, you know, probably good. But so he walked out, and divorce proceedings began pretty much straight away. But then as a result of that, when the divorce article was in the Sydney Morning Herald, another fellow that she had married after Norm left found out that he too was a victim of bigamy. So there was this great kerfuffle in the divorce court.
I wonder if she was able to conceal her tracks reasonably well, just because when you swindle someone, you shame them to some degree.
Yes.
And people then don't speak up, do they? This is the thing I've heard from fraud detectives. They say the problem is getting people to come forward because they feel so ashamed that they've been taken in.
Probably her busiest time in Australia was in the 30s. And she went up and down the East Coast. She kept on the move. That was one of her big things. And also people took you for who you are. You introduced yourself as, you know, my name's Richard Feidler, and people go, well, nice to meet you, Richard. They wouldn't say, well, you know.
Are you?
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
well,
you
that's how society functions. You have to function on this level of basic trust, don't you?
Totally. Well, especially back then. You know, you were who you said you were. And so she just waltzed into places and would cash checks and do all those sort of things just with the easiest means.
So there was a period where she disappeared for a little bit around about this time, and you think you found her. You're not 100% sure, but you think you found her on a boat, on a ship from Melbourne to Perth.
Yes.
What, if it is her, what was this woman doing on this boat?
Oh, it sounds so like her, the language she used. Yes, she stowed away. She'd just come out of jail. And decided to. She was wanted in Victoria, Adelaide, New South Wales, and Queensland, and went right. Okay, let's try Perth, but with no funds. So she was at the port, and there was a boat there, and this vice regal party waltzed in with all the taggers on. And she just attached herself to this group.
Oh, she fitted right in, right,
she,
as a
she
lady.
She totally
right.
did. And told one of the governor's aides that she was an opera singer, because she was carrying a bit of weight by that stage. You know, she was this opera singer. And he, by the name of Eva Taylor, I think,
right.
Eva Turner, and he believed her. You know, so that got all the way to Perth. They dropped her off at the Regent Theatre. Thank you very much.
She didn't have to have a berth or anything on this ship. How did she brazenly?
Well, apparently, when you look at the shipping records, it's written on in pencil at the end.
Oh.
So she's just gone on and said, "Well, I am with the governor's party," and she was given a berth.
Oh. Wow. You even surmised that she might have stowed away on a ship to San Francisco. What happened there,
yes.
if indeed? You can't be shy. Like you said,
no,
I don't think you
I
can
can't.
Be 100% sure.
No.
But what's the story there?
I'd love to. I wish there was a photo. Just a snap of
just
her coming
snap.
Off the boat would have been perfect. It would have. It was, yes, that was, she was trying to get on. Okay, there's a bit of a story attached with that. Break it down. She was trying to get on the ship that had the Australian cricket team on and got kicked off. Because, of course, it was full. There was no spare berths on
right.
that one. So there was another ship leaving the following day that was going to San Francisco. And
why
you know,
not?
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, it was getting a bit hot in Australia.
Yeah.
So she got on this boat, and they were sailing out, and she went into the cocktail lounge, made herself comfortable, started talking with people, got friendly with a fellow that seemed to be travelling by himself, but he wasn't having any bar of her, and that sort of. So she had nowhere to stay. She'd actually put a bag up on a in a lifeboat and came out to get it, and there was the I think he was the engineer Mackenzie was there holding her bag going, you know, are you right?
All
and
right.
So
he was
done. So they actually the company then sent a note back to Sydney Harbour. Rather than turn the boat around, they took her off in New Zealand, sent her off to the Salvation Army, which would have been hilarious. I just cannot imagine Mrs. Livesey in the Salvation Army. And then they popped her on another boat back, and then she was greeted by the press when she
arrived. She was a famous stowaway, was she?
Oh, yes, because, you know, they wanted this story, and she just hammed it up, and it was so her.
What did she tell the press?
Oh, that they treated her dreadfully, you know. It was just awful. It was just this dreadful time, and you know that. And there was a reference to having travelled vice regally.
All right.
And that was when, you know, I put the two trips together, and I went hello, and then went back to the shipping records, and you know, all that sort of stuff. But unfortunately, because there was no formal report or anything about that, I can't prove it was her. But oh, gee whiz, it was such a good story. I had to put it in.
Hooked up with a man in Adelaide and had two sons.
Yes.
Two sons, and she just left them behind pretty quickly.
Yeah, that was quite sad. In the meantime, she'd gone back to England. She'd married an Australian by the name of Anderson. They had two boys, and Mr. Anderson came back to Australia without her, so she followed, couldn't find him, ended up in Adelaide, yes, with a fellow by the name of Gardner.
Where did she leave the boys?
She left them at home. She would often, she and Joseph Gardner would often just take off, and this was actually from her son's family history. They knew how many days they were going to be away, because there'd be a sixpence on the table for every day that they were away, and they were 6 and 7 years of age.
And
so they had to get themselves to school, and there'd be, you know, a bit of food in the cupboard and a sixpence for every day she was away. And then she was when she was arrested for false pretenses in Adelaide, she didn't tell the police for 2 days while she was in custody.
There are these two little
boys at home. It was the depression, and the neighbours noticed that something was up, and they shared what meagre food supply they had with them, and then the child welfare came and took them.
She did a stint in Pentridge in the post-war years. Before the war, for about 5 years, and you say you lost the trail of her for a little while.
Yes.
And then she popped up again. Tell me how that happened.
Oh, that was a very frustrating time. I had just about the timeline of everything else, and there was 5 missing years. I knew she'd been sent to Pentridge, I think it was, for 3 months, and then she disappeared. And I didn't find her again until she was in the Isle of Man in 1943.
The Isle of Man, right, in Britain, yes.
In the UK.
What had she been doing in that five years?
Oh, to find out that was just so satisfying. I had to work backwards at the time, but to go forwards, she'd managed to, she needed some documentation. She had nothing in her own name. She paid, which was quite common, if there were bent justices of the peace, you could buy a birth certificate or a passport. And she chose a new name with 4 movie stars included in her name. and just to make it even better, she took 9 years off her life. So she was then, I think, 31 years of age on her passport. And she didn't have much money after all of that, so got as far as New Zealand and befriended a couple of people on the boat.
Very nice people.
Very nice people, as so many of her things were. And there was an engineering conference on in New Zealand, and the guest speaker was a fellow by the name of William Corradine, who had just retired. He was a retired engineer and tea plantation owner from Ceylon. And he was too good for Ethel to miss because he was very single and very rich.
Right. So she marries him.
Yes.
And this time, now she's really for the first time married into serious money, hasn't she?
Yes, she has.
And there's a baby girl?
Yes, she finds out just before she's 40 that that she's pregnant, and doesn't know what to think about that, really. But yes, she has a little girl, Ethel Mary, who passes away roughly two weeks after she was born. She ends up running away again to the French Riviera, and William Corradine is funding her trip, and she keeps spending, and when he stops the money, she has to, of course, come back. But she tries to, you know, there's a couple of the manager of the hotel she's staying with in the French Riviera, she borrows money off continuously. She probably paid some of it back at some stage. But there's just these stories. She's trying to be the con woman that she can be in Manchester, in Melbourne, Sydney, all these other places. But she is in the land of the rich and famous, and she's a very small fish in a big pond.
Yeah, and also it's con artist central, the French Riviera, isn't it?
It's wonderful. It's
like you've got world-class con artists there, don't you? And they probably would have smelt her a mile away,
exactly,
wouldn't they?
Exactly. So, yes, she ends up back in England. She ends up going to jail. She gets caught passing. She doesn't go back to William Corradine, but ends up passing one of her favourite tricks, passing checks, and is jailed. And then she approaches William Corradine again.
Okay, so she goes back with him and goes to the Isle of Man with him. Now, back to England.
Back to they sell their house in Chelsea, and she wants to move to Blackpool, which was her old stomping ground. And she opens up a stall there, an artificial flower stall.
Now his health begins to fail.
Yeah.
Now I have to ask this question. But as I was reading this, I kept thinking as I was seeing her, I bet she's capable of poisoning someone. This is pure speculation. I'm just putting this out there. And you've mentioned there's no hint of this in your book. So I'm just asking you whether there's any hints to your, or any evidence to your mind that his failing health, she had any role in that, or the death of her child or anything like that. Is there any evidence that you found for that?
No evidence at all. But I think, I must admit, a bit like you, I was thinking this is very convenient because she had met Thomas Liversy.
Another man.
At that stage.
An even richer man.
But, you know, William Corradine was in his 60s, and one of the first people to read this, my draft of this book, is a doctor, and I actually asked him about her lack of empathy, especially in the later years, and he sort of said, look, she's a sociopath. And I went, okay, so, you know, what's that, the difference between that and a psychopath? And, well, the next step is to actually bump someone off, really. I don't know. I really don't, because there was no sort of pattern with it, so I can't. So, yes, no idea.
Okay, so we don't know.
Very long-winded.
So Mr. Corradine dies. She marries Mr. Thomas Liversy, who's much wealthier, and she sets herself up as Lady Muck on the Isle of Man, living in this palatial mansion. Everything's going right for her.
Yes.
She's got all this money at last.
She can't help it.
How does it all come unstuck?
Several things. Her stories start to unravel because she tells people that she tells, for some strange reason, don't know why, she deviated from her story. She told people she was born in Australia. Maybe she thought that they were, it sounded more exotic to people on the Isle of Man. It's her father then comes to stay. Her mother passes away. Her father comes to stay. And he blows that story out of the water.
Nonsense. She's born in Manchester.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes. And so suddenly this, yeah, that's when her story starts to unravel. But she also had been, one of the visitors to the Isle of Man had been a fellow that was a movie producer and was after money and was lamenting the fact that all the movies were going to the War Office because World War II was, of course, happening. So they were making promos, all this sort of stuff. And Ethel, with her love of the movies, and I think that sort of movie star desire, said, oh, we can fund this. And, you know, went about selling one of her dad's properties to do that, but spent the money rather than give it to the producer. And so he's then looking after the money, looking for the money, comes back, and it all sort of blows up, and she goes, right, I'm going.
But I'm off again. Did she take a fair bit of Thomas Livesey's, her husband's, wealth for herself
all
as well?
All of it. Because what had happened, they didn't officially marry. I know.
They were never married?
They were never married.
Right.
Her name was changed by deed poll because Thomas Livesey was already married with children. And when William Corradine passed away, they moved to the Isle of Man and he officially asked his wife for a divorce. She refused. And she was after his money. And so they saw solicitors in Liverpool and the Isle of Man, and all of this is documented. It's quite remarkable. And they changed her name by deed poll, and to keep his funds from his first wife, everything was put into her name.
No.
Oh yes,
oh,
everything.
Man. So
and
she got it all.
He got, and she, you know, she had. It was supposed to be £40,000, which is about the equivalent of $2.5 million today. I know.
God. So she does a runner again.
She does a runner.
She does a runner again, gets on a boat, comes to Australia, gets off in Adelaide to check up on her sons who she hasn't seen for some years, and then gets on a plane to Sydney. And you write that the booking clerk recorded that at this point she was, the clerk recorded that Mrs. Livesey was the heaviest woman he had ever seen.
Yes.
She was obese at this point?
She was pretty big. She was, I think it works out to be about 125 kilos today. I think it was 20 stone. Fairly big. She was 5'6", 5'7". So she was quite tall for a girl back then, but she was very big.
Well, I suppose, the reason why I bring this up is I suppose this isn't good for a con artist. You tend to stand out in the crowd then, do you, if you're unnoticeable?
Yes. But I think it also worked in her favour too with her story. Because to be large then, I mean, this is just post World War II.
Asked to be rich, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, right.
So, and she was spending up big. Like, you should see that in the accounts from the Isle of Man, she's buying up big at the sweet shop, at the bakery, the butcher's, the alcohol, the amount of alcohol she's importing. I mean, she was living it up well and truly.
So arriving in Sydney, this is just amazing.
Oh, yes.
Mrs. Livesey, that's the name she's travelling under because that's the name by deed poll.
Yes.
Has no trouble at all entering into the highest levels of Sydney smart set, Sydney society, post-war smart society.
Oh, she blends right in. She's got the money. She's throwing it around. And she, one of the first families or social groups that she interacts with, at a dinner party, there is a fellow there by the RAF fellow by the name of, I think it was Jack Sharp, and he was from Wales. And when she'd been hiding out at one stage, she'd coming after directly after the Isle of Man, she'd been staying in this hall in Wales. She was renting it only for a month or so. But suddenly this great hall was hers, and her maiden name was Swindells. And this fellow knew of both the Swindell family and this grand hall.
So she had all these plausible stories then.
And suddenly, and she had the money.
Right.
And the story behind it. And that was enough. And she was in.
In high society in Sydney, this is 1946, she meets 45, 46. Mm. She meets and is very quickly engaged to yet another man, James Rex Beach. Mm-hmm. He's over the moon. She's over the moon.
It.
He
yep.
can't believe he's landed such a lovely woman. Tell me a bit about the scale of the engagement and the wedding that those two were planning.
So much money. It's just... Her engagement ring, top of my head, had 43 diamonds and aquamarines. Their engagement party was £300, which was, I think, at that stage, like it was really quite interesting, even following the currency fluctuations between wars and all that sort of thing. But it was about $10,000 they spent on an engagement do, just, you know, with their most intimate friends. They'd booked All Saints Church in Woollahra, that beautiful big sandstone church, a full choir. They had an opera singer, don't you love it, to sing, and a world-renowned flautist. They had doves to be released. She was getting orchids specially grown in glass houses for her bridal bouquets.
Now, I'm just trying to put this in the timeline. This is 1946, and this is still war rationing is going on.
Totally.
And there's been nothing but depression and war austerity all these years.
Yes.
So if she's planning this gigantic bash with champagne and opera singers and choirs and doves and food and whatever, this would have been like a really big deal, the first major wedding of its kind in Sydney for, what, a decade or something?
Definitely a decade. They were even saying that, you know, in the press. And the press got a decent whiff of it, and it was, you know, everyone wanted to know about her. And
yes, there's a photo of her in the Daily Mirror, I think the Sydney newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, Daily Mirror.
Yeah,
and she's sitting there, and she's got a little Pekingese dog on her lap.
Oh, tingling.
Tingling. And she's got some story about that too. And she looks she looks very matronly, but very sweet and innocent.
I know. She could do that. She could look so beautiful. yes, with little Tingling. Yes, Tingling was a gift from another friend. And yes, she even told a great story to the press about that, how she'd had this delightful breed back in Britain and someone had offered her £3,000 for her stud dog. I mean, that's a whole other load of rot. It was just incredible.
So the wedding's been planned.
Yes.
This is this big society event.
Yes.
And then a lawyer friend of her husband-to-be gets suspicious about it. Tell me about the moment he twigs that there's more to Mrs. Livesey than meets the eye.
Yes.
Freda.
Roy MacDonald was a very successful lawyer. His house is actually now owned in Bellevue Hills, now owned by Lachlan Murdoch, and that is the site of where this happened. They were having a game of cards, and he was playing on the table with Ethel, and thought a couple of, you know, the card movements had been a bit strange, didn't think anything of it. And then when they moved tables after a break, he purposely sat so he could watch her, and he saw her slip a card into her bag and grab another. And he instantly thought, how could somebody with this much money do something like that? Like, why? And became suspicious. So didn't say anything at the time, left it. But the wedding, of course, was, I think it was about 6 days later, was due to be about 6 days later. And being a solicitor, he got in touch with people in England and Australia and found out quite a bit about Mrs. Livesey, nee Swindells, nee Anderson, nee Gloria Gray, nee, you know,
Sturgis, blah, blah, blah. Nee Ward, nee Carter. Yes.
And
So he's dug into her background.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what happens, unfolds on the day of Australia's biggest society wedding in the decade.
So they're in her flat in Edgecliff, and she's in her Parisian gown that's been flown out, thank you very much, and bridesmaids, flower girl, the whole lot, having photos taken, and the bridegroom arrives with Roy MacDonald.
Right, before the ceremony.
Yes, yes, they're having photos taken at her beforehand.
And that's bad luck.
Of course, you can't see, and she, you know, you can't see a bride beforehand. But they have an intimate conversation, shall we say, where only some of the facts are actually presented to her, and that's enough for Roy MacDonald to actually say, to suggest to the bridegroom-to-be, Rex Beach, we're leaving and don't marry this woman.
What have they found out? That she's been previously married?
I think the thing that upset Rex Beach the most was that she'd been living in sin with a man on the Isle of Man. They weren't married. So, you know, the main story. But they'd certainly found out about her, the case, outstanding cases still in Adelaide.
Fraud charges against
her. Yes. And that... definitely the thing that upset Rex the most was the fact that she was not the woman that he thought she was.
So the wedding's called off.
It's called off.
2 hours before the ceremony.
And the enormous reception at Australia Hotel goes ahead without them.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was there an announcement made at the reception saying
there is? Yes. There is. And it's huge. In the newspapers, it's hilarious to read, especially the Yellow Press, because they had an absolute ball with it. you know, they're there and they've got the red carpet and there's a crowd outside Australia Hotel because everyone is wanting to see. She had 500 guests She'd only been in Australia about 3 or 4 months. She had 500 guests. She'd invited everyone. And there were people standing outside watching all these people in their finery and jewels going in. And then a couple of the bridesmaids go in with the flower girl, and they're all just going, oh, my goodness. And they start chanting to Here Comes the Bride. Where is the bride? Where is the bride? Yeah, it's, I know. It's just gorgeous. You can just picture it, you know, and the police have to, you know, keep order. But the doors to the banquet room are still bolted shut. And so everyone was going, well, what's going on? What's going on? They eventually let them all in. The banquet manager gets up on stage and says, unfortunately, the bride is unable to attend, but she would like you to, you know, enjoy tonight.
Wow. So they uncork all the champagne and they uncover all the food and what, and they just gorge themselves, right?
In one of the papers, I think it was the Truth, it might have been, it was saying like the minions descended on the free champagne and, you know, and it was just, you know, because it's just post-war Sydney. It had been such a serious time.
So after this is all blown up, this massive media attention, and she just takes off again,
She's
going to Melbourne, but she comes back into Sydney again, but eventually gets picked up by the police. Mm-hmm. And then she has her day in court, arriving, and she looks like $1 million when she arrives at court. Huge crowd outside the courtroom, massive media interest. What was the crowd's attitude to the fraudulent Mrs. Ethel Livesey?
The first time, just after she's arrested, just before Christmas, in 45. They're curious. They, you know, why hadn't the wedding taken place? This amazing, famous, really wealthy woman. You know, they wanted to have a look, and it was quite positive, but it wasn't anything like the frenzy of when she actually had to go to Adelaide to face the charges from 1933 that were still outstanding, because by then she'd paid for the Cine Sound recording that had been showing across the country before every movie, and, you know, telling people that she was innocent and that she'd been taken for granted and all this stuff.
This is another grab from that Telepathe newsreel that she recorded. This is her speaking again to the camera.
I have suffered severely in the past few weeks through the publicity that has been given me, of which I have not sought. I have had many hard knocks in my life. Adversity brought me new friends, friends whom I know are sincere. They come from the mass who had sympathy for a woman who was undergoing a great trial, not the so-called Sydney Society. I take this public opportunity as the only way I can to thank the innumerable people who have written to me. I have had more than 1,000 letters. A number of them have been offering me a home. To these people, I am eternally grateful. I have had a varied life and I have seen much suffering. I went through the Blitz and through the Battle of Britain. I was an air raid warden, and I have helped on many occasions to bring out the maimed and twisted bodies from the rubble. I am very proud to have been able to have done this, because I feel, as an Englishwoman, it was my duty to do so.
Just for the record, Freda, that's total bullshit, isn't it?
It is complete rubbish. But as an Englishwoman, she must do her duty.
The tangled, twisted bodies from the rubble.
Well, the first time I heard that was before I even started researching, and I thought, this is fascinating. No, it's all lies.
All of it lies. Okay, so she has her day. She's got fraud charges in Adelaide. She's found guilty. And it all starts to come down upon her.
Oh, well and truly. At this point.
And she's got to answer fraud charges all over Australia. Mm. Did public opinion about her change once she'd been convicted of fraud?
Yes, very much so. It was noticeable the day before it was decided that she was guilty. There'd even been a woman arrive with maidenhair fern and orchids, and she'd almost curtsied as she'd given this bouquet.
Sake.
I know, yes. to Mrs. Livesey outside the court, and they were calling for her. And, you know, I think the line that got me was as she went in the courthouse, she said, "My stepsons fought for you." I mean, they weren't even her sons anymore. She'd disowned, you know. So then, when it was decided she was guilty, the next day there was a crowd, not as large, but they were quiet. And even the press commented on that. And that was, you know, that was the change. And then from then on, she became pretty much a laughing stock, I think.
She went from place to place around Australia after that. Yes, got picked up again, got picked up for theft.
Yes, yes.
Did time in Adelaide.
Well, she ran out of money. Yeah. All that money she spent.
All that money, all Mr. Livesey's fortune.
All Mr. Livesey's, all Mr. Corradine's, all her father's.
She went through it all.
And she ended up in a bankruptcy court. And... Which is great for research because they document absolutely everything, but it was very sad for all the people that had tried to help her.
She picked up again in Adelaide for theft.
Oh, yes. 2 months
jail. That was
in the 50s. Yeah.
And then she disappears.
Mm. Yes.
Disappears.
She's jailed again, and she's a very sick woman. Now, this comes up probably from the court case in 45. She's repeatedly says she's a sick woman, and I remember reading that and going, yes, well, in what way? But, you know, it was, I think maybe she was ill. She was obese. She smoked like a chimney. She enjoyed the good things in life. I think... Like a lot of people have said, what do you think happened? And we sort of, at the end of the book, we gave two alternatives because she disappears, but the name Livesey was so tainted, as was her, how she looked. She was so recognisable. The last two arrests that she had in the 50s was because she was so big. People recognised her straight away. And if there was anything outstanding... She was nabbed.
You think she might have popped up in Perth at some
yeah,
point?
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
You can't be sure. But
no, I can't.
What was the scam that this woman
that was
running?
Just so naughty. It's very her thug. She would go, and she was a very apparently quite large, well-dressed lady who spoke beautifully. She'd want to buy this beautiful house, and she would convince the real estate agents that she needed to get someone in to check the curtains or the floor or something, and they'd give her the keys. She'd then advertise... to young home buyers, this amazing house at this really cheap price, but they had to pay the deposit right then and there in cash. And there were two cases of that, and then she'd disappear. So it could have been her. It sort of fits, but no, don't know.
Were there any death notices that might
there
have been
there was one
her?
Death notice for a Mrs. Elizabeth Ethel Livesey died in Clare, South Australia, which about 2 years after she came out of jail in Adelaide. And I was very excited. I thought, this is her. And then ordered the death certificates, and it was for an 87-year-old woman. Ethel would have been in her late 50s at that stage, who died of gangrene of the leg. But strangely enough, she died alone, this lady, and it was not reported by the doctor or... by a hospital or anything. It was by a funeral director. And there was a part of me that just wondered, was she trying to bump off the name or was there somebody that actually, you know, because I couldn't find, I have not been to Clare Cemetery, I must admit, but I could not find a grave plot for her. So that was just a possibility. But I really don't know. I'm pretty sure she, personally, I think she took a new name and died not long after because she was so notorious. I think if she'd continued, it would have been easy to find.
Writing this book and following her story, what did finding out about the story teach you about class in Australia at the time and the law?
Oh, a lot is probably, in one word, a lot. Class, it's a really difficult question because I think people are comfortable with who they are. Someone like Ethel isn't. She always wanted to aspire to be someone better. And she was rather unscrupulous in achieving that.
The way she's talking, she sounds like she wants to be the queen to me, actually.
I'm sure she would have loved her.
That sounded like the Queen's Christmas address, didn't it?
All
the intonations and the tone.
Well, she told people she entertained the Prince Regent on her yacht and right. All this sort of stuff. So, yes, I'm sure, because, you know, movie stars and royalty were... her elite.
To me, the key thing in your story for me that reveals her character, though, is that moment at the card table when she has everything and she's still got to cheat at cards.
I know.
She's couldn't help herself.
No.
She's a compulsive fraudster.
Totally. And she's that sort of person that she has to spend what she's got anyway. She had no thought for the future at all. And towards the end, no empathy, which was sad.
Terrifying as well.
Yes.
What a yarn. It's annoying. Bad behaviour is so entertaining, I'm afraid. And yes, we ought to remember her better, I think, in a way. And so I'm grateful for you to have written this book. It's kind of a warning as much as anything, too. Thank you so much, Frieda. Lovely to speak with you about this.
Thank you so much for having me, Richard. It's been great.
Frieda Marty-Nichols is the author of The Amazing Mrs. Livesey.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.